And the House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is now 3:03 p.m. Thursday, February 2nd, 2017, in the State Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Eastman, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Johnston, and myself, Representative Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones all the way off, no vibrate, for the duration of the meeting. Thank you. And then, of course, before we get started, I want to thank Butch Carter, who is the House Hess Secretary from Records, and Alex Beattie Gudice from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. So today, I'm pleased to share that we'll be hearing a presentation from the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. We'll be covering the Council's efforts to address fetal alcohol spectrum disorders and autism. Leading the presentation today will be Christy Reinhart, who's the Program Coordinator for the Governor's Council. Ms. Reinhart, please come up to the desk and introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Sponholz and committee. Thank you. My name is Christy Reinhart. I'm a program coordinator at the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. I'm also a parent of a young man with high-functioning autism that is doing okay at East High School in Anchorage. I'm here today to talk a little bit about our targeted disparity that the Council needed to develop and submit to the federal government about something that we're going to focus on intently for the next 5 years, and how we did that and what we see are some of the challenges for the state of Alaska. And if you have questions, we would entertain questions while we're talking rather than waiting till the end, because this is really meant as information. And my question is, which of these do I use to advance my next slide? Just use the keyboard. There we go.
Let the record reflect that Representative Keto has joined us.
Thank you. So a couple of years ago, as an overview of healthcare for families raising children with special healthcare needs, Women's Children's Family Health is part of a Children and Youth with Special Healthcare Needs federal grant conducted a survey of over 1,000 Alaskan families raising children with special health care needs, and they were able to find from that survey that there were three predominant needs of those families that were voiced. Number one was mental and behavioral challenges, and we've heard this over and over again, these behavioral challenges. Number two was social isolation. It's very difficult to raise a child with a disability, and families were really feeling isolated from their own families and from their community, and that was very loudly voiced within this survey. And number three was bullying. And that was another large issue, was parents' fears that their children were not safe in their community or in their schools.
Ms. Reinhart, we have a question from Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you. Through the chair, just a quick question, please. As I'm looking at your three identified concerns here, I'm looking at the bullying aspect. Does that also include tracking of cyberbullying for these children?
Through the chair, I'm not entirely sure. This I've read an overview, and I could certainly provide their report. They would really love to share it with you, so I could certainly do that. Thank you. That's a very other way. So after collecting this information, what the Council did is the development of our five-year plan, and to look at our targeted disparity is that we went across the state and had focus groups in 15 communities. And we asked basic questions around some of the issues that the Council focuses on, which is going to be early intervention, education, developmental disability services, employment, transportation, child care. And out of that, we heard a lot of other issues that were coming up. And we heard over and over again across the state, not just in urban communities or in rural communities, but consistently heard a message from these communities about gaps in service, particularly around what we are going to call neurobehavioral disorders. So these are the types of hidden disabilities, autism, FASD, traumatic brain injury. But the big ones are autism and FASD, where you can't necessarily look at an individual and tell that they have a disability. And so we heard over and over again that there's, through across the state, huge gaps, depending on the community and, frankly, what time of day it is, what year, what month, in screening and diagnosis. Big gaps in early intervention and education, repeatedly voiced that families with raising children with disabilities, and particularly children with behavioral challenges, find it next to impossible to find childcare, and it impacts their work. The other thing that we heard is once children move out of school-age services at the age of 22, that there's a cliff, that those kids just drop off. One of the things that we've heard over and over again is that we are looking at a tsunami of diagnosis, that for the past 20 years we have improved screening and diagnosis of these neurobehavioral disorders and developed programs in early intervention and in schools, but we have not had a catch-up with our adult services, and that once you age out of the school system, you drop off of a cliff. I don't believe that there was a social system anywhere that was ever developed to expect a doubling of autism diagnosis in as short a period of time as it's happened. The other big question is, where do FASD services live within the state of Alaska? FASD is very prevalent within the state of Alaska. We have a lot of...
Yes, Representative Johnson, you have a question?
Well, I just says, with FASD, are you also doing FASE, or are you putting it all into one?
Through the chair, we are using FASD as fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Okay. So the whole spectrum, rather than just FAS or FAE, we're using it as a spectrum, the same way we would be talking about autism spectrum disorders.
Thank you.
Sure. And Ms. Reinhart, I'll ask you for the good of everybody up here, as you introduce new acronyms, if you could be sure to define those. We find that we have acronym overload, and if we can get the definitions at least once at the beginning, that's very helpful.
Yes,
thanks,
ma'am. Yeah. So the other question is, where do services for fetal alcohol spectrum disorder live within the state of Alaska? We are, in many respects, a pioneer, and still have not been able to solve that question about, is FASD a developmental disorder? Is this a behavioral health disorder? If we're looking at services and supports, where should those live? If we're looking at care coordination, if we're looking at supports, who might be responsible for that, and how can we coordinate that? And I think that that's very emerging. So the other thing we heard was that we have large disparities in referrals. We have inconsistent screening and screening tools. We have inconsistent clinic days. At one time, the state of Alaska had a long-term, absolutely wonderful pediatric neurodevelopmental specialist, Dr. Brennan, who saw children with neurobehavioral disorders for many, many years. Dr. Brennan has retired, and the state has been trying to replace him for several years, has gotten as far as second interview with five or six candidates. Tribal Health has interviewed two, so it's not like we haven't tried. Apparently, when they come up here for the second interview, they figure out this is a long ways away from their family and friends and aging parents, and we haven't made it possible. We haven't found one. There's not very many pediatric neurodevelopmental specialists in the country, and they would like to stay at a good teaching hospital where they can publish and they can have community opera. And so it makes it very difficult, because this is a very hands-on job. Our previous pediatric neurodevelopmental specialist traveled to communities around the state for 15 years, and this is not what most doctors with this kind of education do. So it's trying to bridge that gap in services. We also see that there's a real disparity with where we do have generalists and subspecialists across the state, where they are and how to locate them. And I think that that's going to then bring us to additional limited access, that we need to have evidence-based practices. We need appropriate education. Individuals with brain-based disabilities or neurobehavioral disorders, we're specifically looking at supports and accommodations, professional training for the people that work with them, and that's going to include educators, early educators, service providers, first responders, physicians, people throughout the medical profession, families, and then looking at some of the broader things, looking at insurance and Medicaid program coverage. We do not want to develop systems of support that are not going to be sustainable, that are going to be heavily grant-reliant or excessively grant-reliant on GF funds. Employment and housing, and also how to have meaningful lives that involve community engagement, and looking at some of that isolation that family and caregivers have. This is brand new prevalence data, brand new from the American Academy of Pediatrics, and this is to bring to light, when we are talking about FASD, what does this actually mean? I struggle to think of FASD as being a low incidence disability anymore. If we look at the number of children, and this is school-age children per thousand with autism, we're looking at 12.5 to 14 per thousand. Fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, the new prevalence data is 24 to 48 per thousand.
I have a question. What is the date that this data is from?
Madam Chair, I'm not exactly sure, but it has just been released. Okay. This is brand new prevalence data.
Okay, get that information for us when you get a chance.
Could.
And then this is national data?
Uh-huh.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh, this is national data.
Right. Representative Easton has a question as well.
Yes, I was just wondering, now, as I'm looking at that last number you cited, the 24 to 48, why is there such a wide range in that number?
Through the chair. I believe that the reason is that this is national data, and not all states have good diagnosis. They don't have good screening. Alaska has had screening and diagnostic clinics for many, many years. Not all states do. Not all states have brought this to the forefront. It's incredibly difficult to get firm FASD data, in particular because for a FASD full diagnosis, there needs to be documentation of the prenatal exposure to drugs or alcohol. And not all families, not all mothers, this is difficult information for everyone to have. I have to say that the last American Academy of Pediatric data, which we thought was groundbreaking, that data for FAS just 2 years ago was 2 to 5. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure how new this is, but I know that 2 years that FAS data was 2 to 5.
And sure.
I will certainly provide it to you.
Okay. Representative Kito.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And through the chair, do we have any historic or year-over-year or multi-year data? You mentioned something about a 2.5 a few years ago, but is there anything that can track to identify any maybe trends?
Through the chair, I certainly could find data for you. I know that we have someone who would be more than happy to provide that data for us, that is tracking that for us. We do have a research analyst that is working on FASD prevalence data within the state of Alaska. They don't have firm numbers, and it's not being published, but it will be made available to you as soon as we have it. It's very difficult to find prevalence data, particularly when there's not a requirement for screening.
Mm-hmm. Also, to follow up on that, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders are they're highly difficult to screen for, as you sort of were alluding to earlier, and the only concrete way to get a definition is if a biological mother acknowledges drinking alcohol during pregnancy, which is a very challenging thing for any mother, even a mother who did actually drink, to acknowledge doing, and that what was once thought to be the physiological marker for fetal alcohol spectrum, which is sort of, you know, facial differences, actually account for only a very, very small a number of fetal alcohol spectrum diagnoses. And case in point, one of my daughters is adopted. She joined my family when she was 9, and we were not able to get even a probable fetal alcohol spectrum diagnosis for her for 5 years, and we'll never get a formal one because of that inability to get the corroboration from the biological parent, despite a lot of other evidence. So this is an evolving field of science and a real challenge for our state, especially given our higher rates over the national. So did you want to ask a question, Representative Johnston?
Or maybe add to it, some rural communities where I have been, the stigma is large, and the school systems have not even attempted. And I will say the other aspect of it with some students I've spent time with is when the fetal alcohol effect happened. And so no two children are somewhat alike, and so that provides a problem also.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Please continue.
So now I would like to introduce my colleague, Jean Gearhart-Cyrus, who's going to talk to us a little bit about FASD.
Can you introduce yourself on microphone for the record?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jean Gearhart-Cyrus, and I provided the spelling, and I am from Cayenne.
Thank you.
And thank you for having us. I just want to add one thing about fetal alcohol syndrome is actually a medical diagnosis, and when you're looking at a syndrome, it's a lot easier to recognize those features. And with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, you may not have any of those features, and so that provides much more of a challenge. Mm-hmm. I think Christy addressed high prevalence. Referral and screening, the other thing I would like to add is that we don't have a good screening tool for FASD. It's being looked at. A lot of people have tried to find one, and we don't have. We have a screening tool for TBI. I believe there's a screening tool for autism, but mm-hmm. not for FASD. And again, because it is so varied, depending on when the exposure is, how much, and the individual biology of the birth mom and the child. I should identify myself. My husband's back there, and we are parents of multiple children with prenatal exposure to alcohol, mm-hmm. and several with very intensive needs. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big issue with the screening. The majority of the referrals for diagnosis actually come through the Office of Children's Services, because they are able to pursue that diagnosis. They have more access, and also it's less of an emotional kind of, the stigma is very real for people. We really need, that's an issue we need to address, to recognize, you know, we recognize alcoholism is a disease, but then when we get to the point of fetal alcohol, a lot of judgment enters into it, and that stigma is very real. A lot of the children in the first foster care system who are having those behaviors, and that's often the first time people are recognized, is because of behaviors that are emerging, are served in therapeutic foster homes. And we are working towards getting good training. They do have some training in dealing with those behaviors and are provided information, but it's certainly not at the level where we feel it needs to be. There's still work to be done. We have several diagnostic teams across the state and have had and that's varied from year to year. I was actually a coordinator for our diagnostic team in the Northwest Arctic, which didn't last very long. And some of those teams are consistent. You know, in the major hubs, we have more consistent teams, and others vary according to how many they have on their team, who their staffing is. If they lose a pediatrician, then there's a long delay in getting a pediatrician, and those kinds of issues. People with FASD are often served by systems. Unfortunately, it's very often as a result of a crisis situation. They're very often seen in ER. They're seen through the Office of Children's Services. Corrections is a huge provider for this population, unfortunately. And residential treatment as parents. Very often, that's your first service that's offered to you, is residential. And that's not a good yeah. alternative. We need to have a sustainable infrastructure to provide the range of services that are needed over the ages and to be able to keep them going. Very often the issue with FASD compared to, say, autism or other disabilities is most people with an FASD and do not qualify for developmental disability services because, for one, they come across as very competent. They're usually verbal, highly verbal, and they do have a developmental disability, but they do not qualify unless they have extreme needs, in which case they would qualify anyway, will not qualify for developmental disability services. They are assumed competent, and when they have behaviors that arise, they're assumed that those behaviors are malicious. And so that's when they end up with DJJ or in the correctional system to address those behaviors, even within the school system. We've certainly lived through that, instead of being recognized as a disability. And so the issues that come up first are more mental health, behavioral health issues. And people are often misdiagnosed as oppositional defiant disorder mm-hmm. or having ADHD, now I'm trying to think of the not acronym for that.
Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder.
And these may be co-occurring, but very often the fetal alcohol issue is completely missed in that. Let's see. Okay. The state of Alaska is a pioneer in this field. We are the only state that in our education regs has fetal alcohol spectrum disorders listed as a diagnosis under other health impaired. We also recognize the role of nurse practitioners within the state of Alaska in assisting with diagnosis. We don't have enough pediatric physicians available to do the diagnosis, and so that was huge for us to get that. I welcome any questions. I have a wealth of personal experience. I like to say I know more than I never wanted to know of health systems. But, you know, in particular, we have a daughter who at 7, the school was encouraging us to look at residential placement. Mm. And we said no. Well, she did end up at API for a period of time, came out with a list of diagnoses this long and a list of medications this long, which we've fortunately been able to whittle down. We've had the advantage of her being able to intern with a family business in our community, which has been life-saving, and also had access to the Complex Behavior Collaborative, which turned the school experience around. She was restrained and secluded up until 8th grade, and has been on the honor roll her entire high school career. She has one high school class this year. She's taking her third college class and will graduate in May. And she was the recipient of a Young People of Achievement Award this November, which mm-hmm. brought lots of tears.
It was a proud moment for many.
Any questions?
Actually, I think in the interest of time, we should just continue to proceed on, and if people have the opportunity to chat with you afterwards, I'm sorry. Yeah. Thank you so much. And I want to take a moment before we pass the microphone over to just thank you, I think on behalf of the committee, but definitely personally, for your remarkable personal leadership in caring for kids who are often extremely challenging to care for. The leadership that you've demonstrated shows the full potential of what our kids with fetal alcohol that are on the fetal alcohol spectrum can do, and I think your daughter's recent award as a young person of achievement is a great illustrator of that. I met her personally and was very impressed by her. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Hello, I'm Jill Burkert. I'm with the Governor's Council, but in my other life, I am the program coordinator for special education, teacher education at the University of Alaska Southeast. And what I'm about to say has been covered, I think, in many ways, but I wanted to address some of the prevalence data that you were asking about. With respect to autism, and again, you know, we have the some of the same kinds of issues in the field of study of autism that FASD encounters, which is inconsistent screening and identification. But if you look historically at autism prevalence, it was first identified as part of or included in the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, the Special Education Act, in 1990. And at that time, the Center for Disease Control prevalence data was 1 in 1,000. Fast forward to 3 years ago, and CDC, Center for Disease Control, said the prevalence data was 1 in 200. Now, Center for Disease Control says 1 in 68. And if you look at the prevalence data that that Christy presented and you divide 14 into 1,000, you come out with pretty close to 1 in 68. I think it's 1 in 71. Mm-hmm. So based on that prevalence data for the state of Alaska, we are pretty consistent. Just prior to the meeting, we looked up on the Department of Education website. And in the state of Alaska, as of fiscal year 16, and this data was taken on October 2015, there were 18,390 special ed students in the state of Alaska. And of those, 1,335 were identified as having autism. However, some of that data we would really need to interrogate, and we'd really need to look at a little bit more closely, because there were a number of very small districts that may have had less than 5 students and may not have necessarily either identified or reported that they have students who may have the characteristics of somebody who has autism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, once again, we're having the same sort of difficulty as really pinning down just exactly how many students do we have. I can certainly say that there have been more efforts, it seems, in the area of autism to identify younger children in the 0 to 3 population, the ages and stages questionnaire is used. However, ages and stages questionnaire is what we call a self-report questionnaire, and it's more of a screening device. As Christy pointed out earlier, our one neurodevelopmental psychiatrist is no longer with us, and many of the families, because of the lack of ability to contact providers who could, you know, do a treatment or a diagnostic procedure, and long wait times, oftentimes have to fly to Seattle or other states in order to achieve a diagnosis or to have a diagnosis. So the question of screening, then diagnosis, is sometimes very difficult to move from one component or one aspect of the process to the next. Without a diagnosis, you're going to have difficulty developing a treatment plan. So, okay. many of the same things that Christy had talked about are true for autism, and I know we're running out of time, so I will stop.
Thank you. So I just want to wrap this up and say that the Governor's Council has two committees that we're working on to make sure that efforts around autism and FASD are not siloed, that these are coordinated efforts involving public health, behavioral health, education, early intervention, the Center for Human Development, the University Center, parent support organizations, service providers. We have developed a five-year plan for autism at the request of the legislature. At the close of the task force, autism task force, we were asked to continue to coordinate efforts around autism. We put the band back together and have developed another five-year plan. We are doing the same thing for FASD. So we are here to tell you that we are here for a resource if you have questions, and also to provide information about what kind of systemic improvements that across the state of Alaska we're trying to do to move the needle forward with supporting individuals with neurobehavioral disorders.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions they want to ask quickly before we close out the meeting?
If I could, please.
Thank you. Just really quickly, you know, you talked about the shortage of physicians in this particular area. Are you working maybe on a homegrown kind of concept with Miami Witchy programs at all?
Through the chair. We are looking at several different models for a homegrown program. One of them is to give the pediatricians and advanced nurse practitioners within the state an opportunity to get the specialized training that they need for diagnosis. So we're exploring developing that with the University of Alaska's LEND program. We're also looking at training the family navigators that it would be part of a multidisciplinary diagnostic team to do that bridge between diagnosis and services that family needs, that they would also then train with that LEND program. Currently, the way that diagnosis is happening within the state is we have two pediatric neurodevelopmental specialists that come from the University of Washington, so they are looking at trying to help us with kind of expanding that. We've tried desperately hard to hire one of them. It hasn't. She's not willing to give up her chair. So that's really, we know that that's one of the pieces is looking at that, growing our own diagnosticians. But for looking at those specialists, they're going to have to come out of a big school.
All right. I want to thank you very much for coming to present on this important issue. The time is 3:35. I want to thank the indulgence of the subsequent committee. This hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is adjourned. Note that the House HES Finance Subcommittee will begin momentarily. It's my understanding that we need about 1 minute to close down and reboot our communication system before we can launch the next committee. Thank you. Thank you.